Okay, everybody, this is Stephen Dynan, and welcome back to Next Evolution of Health. For those who have been in groups, between the last call and this one, we're going to dissolve the groups now so that we can participate in the full call. We have an hour with two of just some of the most joyous and wonderful pioneers at the frontiers of integrative medicine around. We have Bernie Siegel with us and Dr. Joan Borisenko. So I'm going to introduce them in a moment. They're both just truly delightful souls, so we're honored to have them in dialogue today. So I'll first say a few words about Bernie Siegel. He is he's really one of the original pioneers of the field of kind of integrative medicine, and he prefers to go by Bernie. He attended Colgate and Cornell and it's a surgical training in Yale, and in 1978 originated Exceptional Cancer Patients, which was creating a specific form of individual and group therapy utilizing patients' drawings, dreams, images, and feelings. It led to books like Love, Medicine, and Miracle, Peace, Love, and Healing, and How to Live Between Office Visits and Prescriptions for Living. He's currently working on other books with a goal of humanizing medical education. So he's really been at the forefront of this work for many decades. Bernie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Great. And in dialogue with Bernie, we have someone who I've just been getting to know on a deeper level and just loving her. She's both a pioneer in the field of integrative medicine, but also a real... Her name is Joan Borisenko. She's work has been foundational in creating an international healthcare revolution that recognizes the role of meaning, the spiritual dimensions of life, as integral parts of health and healing. She, in the 80s, she co-founded the Mind-Body Clinic with Herbert Benson and became a licensed psychologist and was an instructor at the Harvard Medical School. And that's afterwards led to New York Times bestseller, Minding the Body, Mending the Mind, which sold over 400,000 copies. And she's the author or co-author of 13 other books and director of the Claritas Institute Interspiritual Mentor Training Program. So, Joan, thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. I'm absolutely psyched for this. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, Joan.
Bernie,
yes,
my buddy.
We go way back together, right? You know, I have to tell you something. If I can, to start with, because you work, you know, with Herbert Benson. And, you know, when I was starting this, everybody was calling me crazy, and therefore I was on all the famous talk shows with people yelling at me. But I remember a phone call from Herbert saying, Bernie, I want to thank you. I said, for what? He said, you're out there causing all that trouble, so I'm getting to do things and getting things accepted that wouldn't have been if it weren't for you. And,
that's
you know,
true.
And slowly, obviously, medicine has changed. Things that I was called crazy for are now scientific. But what's sad is it takes decades for somebody to just say, let's do the research. Because that was another criticism. Have you done any research? No. Well, the answer no was because nobody would support it. If I'd call up NIH or American Cancer Society and say, I'd like to do some research. Oh, that's nuts. We're not going to, you know, fund research that we can't believe in. So you got criticized for not doing it and criticized when you tried to do it. And when people did the research to prove I was wrong and it came out right, then, oh, hey, maybe there's something to this. So, you know, 20, 30 years later, studies on loneliness, laughter, relationships, all these things suddenly have become scientific.
That's right. Social support. Do you know, in 1992, when I moved out of Boston, I became a renegade, and I defected from Harvard, and I moved to the mountains of Boulder, Colorado. You sent me a postcard, Bernie, and I don't know if you remember it, but I still do. And it said, moving to Boulder, bad move, because you're going to get complacent since everybody there thinks the way that you do. I bet you forgot that, right?
No, that, well, I mean, I know that's the kind of thing I would do, right?
Yeah, yeah, that is the kind of thing. But here's the strange thing, Bernie. The traditional medical community here does not think the way that I do or you do or Benson does or Dean Ornish does.
Right.
They're still very traditional. And what we've had here, which actually saddens me, is a kind of two-track medicine developing, because Boulder is also like the epicenter of network chiropractic, and we have a tremendous massage school, and there's a lot of very fine oriental medicine practitioners. and many, many therapists who recognize the role of the emotional life in healing. And yet, the two camps still aren't speaking to each other.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how that is on the East Coast and where you are.
Well, I'll tell you, the problem is, I call it receiving a medical information. We don't get a medical education. And this is just beginning, you see, to creep into the schools. For instance, I get a call, you know, come speak at our medical school. Why? Because the students have formed an integrative medicine elective group, and they're inviting me. You see, it's not coming from the dean who wants to make you a part of the faculty, that type of thing. So, you know, here I am in next to Yale University. I don't get called to come there and speak. When the chaplain, who was a retired physician, interestingly enough, went back to divinity school. Yes, when he was the chaplain in the medical school, I was there all the time talking with the students because he was inviting me. But, yeah, to me, it's a tragic event that what I call, you know, dealing with the patient's experience of illness. And, well, I don't know if you saw the article in USA Today a few days ago, how there's very little rapport between patient and doctor. And it's, again, the lack of training. We're taught about technology. I mean, this is a literal ad from the New England Journal of Medicine that I love showing as a slide. I was depressed, unable to cope. I went to see my physician. He prescribed an antidepressant. I feel better now. I wrote to journal. I wrote to Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company. I said, I have to tell you, my family was killed in a plane crash. I'm depressed. Don't you think the doctor ought to ask me what's going on in your life before he prescribes a pill? And they canceled the ad. But I think that's,
Canceled the ad. Good for you, Bernie. You're still rabble-rousing. I love that.
But, I mean, it's, you know, again, to say to a patient, this is something, again, I've learned. When I say to them, what are you experiencing? The words that come out of people are always about their life and therefore contribute to their illness, meaning that if they say failure, pressure, draining, all these, I mean, I always say, a few people say wake up call, blessing, new beginning, because they've awakened to a new life due to their mortality. But the others, when you say, how does failure fit your life? Oh, my parents committed suicide. It must have been a failure as a child. Oh, what's causing the pressure? Well, my marriage. And how much improvement, literally, a woman I know who was about to be admitted to the hospital for migraine headache for a week, and she was just unable to cope, when she used the word pressure and it related to her marriage, she got up and went home free of pain to go work out her marriage or eliminate it for that matter.
That's absolutely great because it's so true. You know, since you and I were last worked together, that whole ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experience study, has come out, and there have been many iterations of it. But that was an enormous study at the San Diego Kaiser Permanente. And what they showed was the absolute best predictor of adult health was what happened to you in childhood.
Absolutely.
And all this unhealed stuff. And Robert Anda, who's a physician from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, came in to collaborate on that study. And he said, why don't they teach us that in medical school?
Yes.
We don't understand how to take a history.
It's such a simple – I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah.
No, go ahead, Bernie.
When you say history, yeah, we start out with what's your chief complaint? You know, I got a pain in my back. But it's not about what's going on in your life. And I literally feel that – the biggest public health issue on the planet is parenting. I mean, we know this from studies. You know, if you're unloved by your parents, 98% have a serious illness by midlife.
That was a study of our students, too.
And those who said, my parents loved me, I think it was something like 28 or 29%. And here's a quote from a woman. My mother's words were eating away at me and maybe gave me cancer. She grew up with a mother who dressed her in dark colors and told her she was a failure. And she had to get cancer to buy a red dress and start a new life. But the thing I see, I'm always saying to people, what's the opposite of love? It's indifference. It's not hatred.
Absolutely. It's not.
Yeah, if you're a troublemaker, you get attention.
What do you do?
And then rejection and abuse. And it's, well, here's a line that impressed me from East of Eden by John Steinbeck, all experience rejection. And with rejection comes desire for revenge. And with revenge comes guilt. And there is the story of mankind. I read that, especially when you look at the headlines today, from Virginia Tech to whatever. You know, you receive rejection, you get angry, you want to retaliate, then you feel guilt, you kill classmates, and then you commit suicide. Or you go to work and kill your coworkers, and then you kill yourself. I mean, it goes on. And if love were there, what a difference it would make to the whole world.
Well, it certainly would. And you're right. It starts with parenting. And it goes on. One of the things in the ACE study, they looked at just the things that you were talking about, Bernie, you know, various categories of what happened in childhood. Maybe you had a parent who was absent for some reason, or some parent who was imprisoned, or a parent who was depressed. That's a big one. Or maybe you were abused sexually or physically or neglected. And they added up the score. There were 6 categories of abuse. And here's a fascinating statistic. People who have an ACE score of 4 or more are 5,000 times more likely to be depressed as an adult. Yes. And you and I both know from doing research, we used to get all excited about, boy, there's a 0.01 enhancement of whatever it is. This is 5,000 times more. And you see that, too, with things like health habits. Like, why can't people give up cigarette smoking? Or why can't they stop overeating? And what they found in this study, because they really asked the patients, they asked their people, what's going on with you? What was your history? They found something so fascinating. And that is that, for example, a 22-year-old woman who was obese, when they took her history, they found this. She said, I know why I'm obese, because I was raped. In the year after that I was raped, I gained 100 pounds because it's the only way that I feel safe. And they suddenly realized obesity was not her presenting problem. It was her best attempt at a solution to her problem. And it's the same thing with cigarette smoking. It's an early history that, you know, gives you an ACE score of maybe 4 or 5 that makes people much more prone to not being able to give up smoking, much more prone to drug abuse. And the other part of this that I want to talk about, Bernie, is the fact that physicians and nurses and therapists are so burned out. The burnout rate is incredible, that when you yourself are burned out, which, and burnout is a very specific thing. I mean, there are 3 indications of being burned out. Number one, you're just emotionally exhausted, just totally done for, you're fried. And secondly, you develop compassion fatigue. You're really not empathetic anymore. You can't listen to someone else's story. You know, you kind of just wish they'd go away. And that, of course, leads to the third aspect of healthcare provider burnout and burnout of the rest of us, which is just feeling like, oh, my God, I can't get anything done. I'm losing my productivity. I'm losing my function. And when we talk about healing our healthcare system, when our healthcare providers are burned out, the large majority of them, that's the research, no matter what specialty you're looking at, no wonder they can't relate. And what we really do know, Bernie, is the relationship is the medicine. Augmented by other things, but primarily it's relationship. It's to be seen, it's to be understood, that has this tremendous physiological, emotional, and spiritual impact on a person that is really the heart of healing.
Take a step back with all the things you've said. The work of Alice Miller said our childhood is stored up in our body, and though we can repress it, we can never alter it. And it ends with, and someday the body will present its bill, for it is as incorruptible as a child, while still whole in spirit, will accept no compromises. And it will not stop tormenting us until we stop evading the truth. So we can learn from our body, too. And addictions, as she said, and I believe, is a search for feelings that you've never had in a healthy way. So what we need to understand is people don't need information. They need inspiration. What I've learned is I reparent people, see? I mean, a young woman made it very clear to me one day by saying she was suicidal. You're my CD. I said, what do you mean I'm a CD? She said, you're my chosen dad. So there are people alive and well today because, well, I got a phone call saying, do you have Jack Kevorkian's phone number? My father sexually abused me. I have a brain tumor, and I want to be dead. I said, I love you, Becky, and you're a child of God. Send me some drawings. And we worked on that. But Becky is alive today. I've become her father. And she's a totally different young woman. Even, I mean, something a member of the clergy said to me, oh, yes, I tell people to pick a new name and start a new life. So Becky is Rosie today. And,
you know, there's an old Jewish practice, Bernie.
That's right.
Practice.
Yeah.
If you're sick, you change your name because the angel of death can't find your address.
That's right. But you see, all these old messages, whether it's Buddha, Bible, you know, Talmud or anything else, or for that matter, an AA meeting, they're telling you how to recover and how to survive. So I call it rebirthing yourself, you know, that you pick the role you want to play in your life and you start. And we also know from drawing blood and actors that if you're in a comedy, it enhances immune function and, you know, and cortisol levels go down and so forth. And if you're a tragedy, the opposite. So people need to get up and work at it. And the other is when you talk about, I talk about burning up and burning out. See, I'm
That's
burning
why
up.
I wanted to name that. I remember that from years ago. Be passionate, you'd say. Burn
if
up.
If you're burning up, you take a nap and you feel better. Burning out, a nap is of no use because you don't like your life. But, I mean, doctors, you know, Monday morning, more heart attack, stroke, suicides, and illnesses, okay? So it's not just doctors. I mean, we all have to look at, am I enjoying my life? You know, I said to patients, give me a hug. I let them restore me, too. But I found also that when you reparented your patients, and I mean this literally, that people are totally self-destructive, and I give them a hug and say, I'll see you next week. And they looked at me like, how come you're not telling me not to come back like all the other doctors? But 6 months later, they begin to change because I had reparented them. And I have to add one more from one boy that we all must remember we have a choice. This is a young man, Tony, who was sexually abused, developed AIDS, and that's when I saw him trying to help him survive. And one day he called me up and he said, Dr. Siegel, yes, I'm going to commit suicide. I said, no, Tony, I have friends in New York. I grew up with mafia, and what we'll do is get a gun and we'll kill your parents.
And
I talk like that to people. And he said, No, he said, I don't want to be like them. That blew my mind, that this kid, instead of being destructive, rather kill himself than hurt anyone. And I have to tell you a happy ending to the story. When he went down to, as he said, to jump in front of the A train, the subway, the train was late. And I got a call from him saying, there's no train, you know, where am I supposed to? And he looked around the station and saw the 800 hotline for suicide. And they came and rescued him. And as he said, I learned about love, you know, from a new family who took him in and took care of him. And it changed his life. But, the choices that we all have. And if you don't like being a doctor, fine, stop. But believe me, it isn't about being a doctor. I mean, I meet landscapers who hate people because it's so hard to work for them. And
well, that's
we need
right.
To learn
exactly.
How to enjoy people.
I think everybody these days is, you know, everybody says, I'm fried, I'm burned out. And what happens when people say that and they go to the family doc is they usually leave with a prescription for antidepressants.
Yeah.
And their problem is twofold. Number one, they're not depressed anyhow. They've given in to a feeling of helplessness. They're burning out instead of burning up with their passion, number one. And number two, there's all that very good research that except in very severe cases, antidepressants don't work any better than a placebo. They got side effects.
Right.
So I think we need you, Bernie, and we need to learn, what is it to learn how to have fun again, to laugh again, to heal from our childhoods. And well, people somehow or other don't recognize, even still, even after all these years, that that's truly the key to good health.
Yeah.
And just I can tell you
very simply, because what I've learned is I'm a multiple personality. I have a fella in me, for instance, who talks kind of funny, like I'm sharing with you now. People often ask me where I'm from, and I tell them I'm from Connecticut. Why do you ask? And I had an electrician. I had a problem in the house. It's a true story. And the bathroom lights were not working, and the electrician kept telling me how busy he is. So I called his house with his voice, and I said, I was at Dr. Siegel's house yesterday, and I was in the bathroom, couldn't find toilet paper. My wife couldn't fix her makeup. Dr. Siegel felt bad, but those lights just don't work in that bathroom. You ought to really, he's a nice guy, you ought to go out to his house. Well, in a few hours, the electrician was at our house telling me that this guest of mine had called, and they fixed everything. And then I called them and said, I want you to know that was no guest, that was me. And so we all had a wonderful, hysterical time. But because it brings out the kid in them. You see, I'm always saying to people, how may I help you? I mean, imagine pulling up to a toll booth and saying, how may I help you? And the person saying, come on, get out of the car, collect tolls, let me go home. See? The other day, I saved $5 because I pulled up from a parking garage, and I said, don't forget my senior discount. I'm a senior, and the car is an old car. And I start laughing and said, never mind, go ahead. I saved $5 because he just, you know, waved me on because it left him laughing. So I literally, if I'm sent a contract that says sign here, I write here on it and mail it back. And I get lawyers who say, thank you, we're laughing, but we need your autograph, you know, when they receive it in the mail. So I keep saying to people, don't let the kid in you die. Stop worrying about what other people think. Be that crazy little character. Because we're all wounded. This is something else. I mean, two true stories, then, you know, I'll stop for a moment to give you a chance. But in Stop and Shop, where I go for therapy, because I love interacting with people, in the back.
See, it's not politically incorrect. You're supposed to go to Whole Foods for therapy.
Oh, I see. All right. Well, but no, they have organic stuff there, too. But anyway, this woman pokes me in the back. She had a bandage over her eye, and I thought this was really impressive. She said, you're the only person in Stop and Shop who hasn't asked me what happened. See, the kid in me answered her. I said, because I know what happened. I have an abusive spouse also. And she looked at me like, what? But I said, no, I'm a doctor, so a bandage didn't affect me. But you see, she has a visible wound, and everybody is talking to her. They're getting into therapy with her. What I used to say at the checkout counter, or to anybody who would say to me, how are you today? I'm depressed. I've run out of my antidepressant, and my doctor's away on vacation, so I can't refill my prescription. And one day, my wife, Bobby, said to me, honey, you think that's a joke. They don't. I said, what do you mean? Said, you're not paying attention to the answers. And I started really listening, and 80% of people were saying, I know how you feel. And literally, in the line behind me, if you don't believe me, anybody listening, do this tomorrow at the supermarket. The people in line behind you open their pocketbooks and say, will mine help? One kid who was checking me out said, come on to my locker. I have 6 kinds of antidepressants in my locker. Maybe one will help you. And that's what we all have to realize. The world is wounded. Help each other. As Thornton Wilder wrote, an angel refuses to heal a doctor. And the doctor says, hey, I got troubles too. But the angel finishes with, without your wound, where would your power be? It's your melancholy that makes your low voice tremble into the hearts of men. The very angels themselves cannot persuade wretched and blundering children on earth as can one human being broken on the wheels of living. In love service, only the wounded soldier can serve. Draw back. And on the way home, the doctor realizes the angel's right, because everybody tells him, you know, my family will only talk to you. My family, my son will only talk to you, because he's wounded, and they're not, you know, he's what I call a native, not a tourist, so they share with him. And that's what doctors also have to understand.
Now, I think doctors also need to know, if somebody comes in and they're wounded, where do you send them for help? And I just want to say how much help my patients, my friends, my family, and myself gained from the Hoffman Quadrinity process over the years. You know, first of all, I was married. You remember Myron. married to Myron years ago. Myron went to the Hoffman process. It's 1 week of kind of I can't say you complete it, but you do an awful lot of work with your family of origin and the wounds you had, and you finish your anger, you get it out, the anger, the grief, the understanding of how you've internalized the patterns of your parents and what they do to you. And then you have the next part of the week has a great deal to do with developing compassion to your parents, who only were the way they were if they weren't so great, because they too were wounded. The wounds are handed on all through the lineage. That did more good for me and brought me to a sense of forgiveness, of self-forgiveness, of being able to drop so much of that mask that we put on so that we're going to look lovable to others, and instead to just risk being myself. And it did a great deal of good for Myron. And then our oldest kid went. Of course, that was a lot of fun because you have to do 2 days' worth of homework before you even get to the week-long process, filling in all these various patterns like people-pleasing or overwork or whatever it is. And then you have to say, well, which parent of mine did that? Am I adopting their patterns or am I rebelling against them and therefore adopting another pattern? And I said to my son, Justin, gosh, Justin, how was that? And he said, I needed continuation pages. So it was great because we had a chance when he was still young, because he was only 20 when he did that, to really see each other, really see each other and recognize, my God, the world is a difficult place. We all do the best we can. And when we can understand that, when we can admit what we've done, when we can love each other and forgive each other, everything shifts. And that, so I still say for the listeners, go Google the Hoffman Quadrinity process if you're interested in taking a week of your life and changing your life. So you got to address those wounds, Bernie. They don't go away by themselves. Lucky enough to shop with you.
I mean, one of our, you know, the things that gets people to change is the fact that we're mortal. See, I have letters from people saying, I was told I had 2 months to live. So I went home and I bought a dog and I put it in the backyard wildlife. You know, it goes on and on about all the things they did. And the letter ends with, I didn't die, now I'm so busy I'm killing myself. Help, where do I go from here? I told her to take a nap. But, I mean, you know, and I don't make up these letters. So what I found is if you accept your mortality, that you're going to be dead one day, then why be unhappy and miserable? Why give your power away? I mean, this lesson really came across to me in a very practical way. Bobby and I were in a hotel, and our room was robbed. I mean, it was obviously an inside job. You know, the door was open with a key. It wasn't broken into. And there was this weird guy in the hallway standing there. And I thought, why would somebody stand in a hallway? Well, it wasn't smart. I wasn't smart enough. So we go to dinner, come back, and obviously this guy had gone in our room and robbed it. And I got up for months, you know, hating that, I don't want to use the language over on this program, but, you know, every day I wished I was in the hallway, I'd get even, I'd do it. And I realized, hey, Bernie, he's still robbing you. And it was about this time of the year. And I realized, oh, it's Christmas. Why don't I, you know, find out who it is and send him a couple $100 so he can buy some nice gifts for his children with what he robbed from us. And then I'm smiling, and it changed the whole context. And I used it again when one of our sons had his house robbed. I happened to be there when he realized it, and he's on the phone with the police. I said, hey, calm down. What do you mean, calm down? I said, look, the guy who robbed you hasn't bought his mother a birthday present in 10 years. Now he's got something. He can go buy his mother a present. And my son looks at me and starts smiling, but, I mean, knowing his father's insane, but he's smiling, and it took all the tension and anger out of him. And I think this is what we have to understand. We have the power. You're here for a limited time. What do you want to do with your lifetime? You want to be miserable, unhappy, and blame everybody? So I call it survival behavior, you know, that you can express emotions. You're not here to please everybody. You can ask for help. You know, say no to things you don't want to do. You participate in decisions about your treatment. You find what I call a play, but what makes you lose track of time, what you enjoy doing, and you use your pain. This helped me most. I was having an unhappy day, what I call gnawing unrest, a term from Jung, when a friend of mine gets on the phone and says, "Bernie, what? If you're hungry, do you get upset?" "No." "What do? "I get something to eat." Then ask yourself, what nourishment do you need? And boy, that has helped me. So no matter what your emotion, if you said to yourself, what do I need to bring into my life? How do I need to nourish myself in my life? Then you don't get depressed about being depressed or angry about being angry. You say, okay, what has led me to this? What do I need to do so it doesn't keep recurring? And, you know, I call them labor pains. You use your pain to grow and change, not just to go get another pill, but to learn from it and rebirth yourself.
Yes, and to really enjoy life, to be passionate about life. And that's, you know, that's hard when you're starting out, when you're feeling like, oh, I'm burned out, oh, I'm depressed. There's nothing that gives me joy anymore. It's really important even to think, well, what used to give you joy? What did you used to like when you were still a kid? And that there was a period for me when I felt like that. In fact, I've burned out a couple of times, which is why I've got a book coming out in a week called Fried, and the subtitle is Why You Burn Out and How to Revive. And what I found was important for revival, which may sound strange, was bowling. When I was a kid, my brother and I lived to bowl. We lived in walking distance of a bowling alley, and they had the duck pins, you know, the small pins, the small balls. And we don't have those out west. We get the 10 pins and the big balls, but it was close enough. I went to the bowling alley. I started to bowl. Pretty soon I started to laugh, and I realized, hey, Joan, not dead yet. There's still life force in there. And you have to really fan the flames. And I got fascinated with some of the work of Ellen Langer. Do you remember her counterclockwise study, she called it? She took a bunch of older folks, like me, like you. They were all men, though. She took them off to a monastery in Peterborough, New Hampshire, for a week, and she recreated a time 20 years before in the 50s. So they spoke about news from the 50s. They listened to radio and records and television shows from the 50s. And it was amazing. They had fun. They were reminiscing about a time in their life when they had felt passionate, and suddenly they were more flexible. All of their, you know, scores of well-being and medical scores improved simply because they had tapped in to their life force. They tapped into their passion.
That's why I don't grow up. I mean, literally, people come up to me and say, you haven't changed. And what I often say to them is, see, think of this. You do what you really enjoy. For me, I would totally lose myself if I was operating on someone because I cared about them. But I, as an artist, if I'm painting a portrait, I have no sense of time either. And my comment is, if you do what makes you lose sense of time, how can you get older? I mean, if you never knew what time it was, how do you age? And I really think that that is the healthiest trance state you can ever be in. Because if you spent 3 hours doing something and thought it was 15 minutes, then my comment is, you're only 15 minutes older. And I think why, you know, the people who love their work, this is a quote from George Halas, who owned the Chicago football team. And somebody said, I went to the office on Sunday to get something. I left there, and he's sitting there working. And he said, George, at your age, he was either 80 or 90 or something, what are you doing here working? He said, it's only work if there's someplace else you'd rather be. And you see, so if we never work, I'd say that changes the aging process too. All these things people have to realize are our internal chemistry. Every emotion is our chemistry. And I must add one more thing that, you know, because you were talking again about placebo, how powerful the mind is. That's something I've learned, that when people think they're receiving treatment, they act as if they are. And that includes things like chemotherapy, radiation, even surgery. If you make an incision but don't do anything more than that, people wake up and feel better. And I know people whose tumors have shrunk when they thought they were being radiated and the machine had no radioactive material in it. and they were having side effects, other people who, again, thought they were being treated. So your attitude towards treatment. And the thing that doctors also aren't told is that Carl Jung interpreted a dream and correctly diagnosed a brain tumor. So that's why I get into dreams and drawings, because the body speaks to us also through those symbols. And that's something that needs to get into medical school also. So
it really does. And actually, that's a very good idea. You know, last October, I started a new program. I've got a course now that happens at Omega Institute called Soul Care in Healthcare for healthcare providers. And one thing that I think I need to add to that is dreams, because you get so much health information from dreams.
Just for your course, you ask the health professionals to draw themselves working as doctors or nurses or whatever? Because please do that.
Right.
I get, when I work with the medical students, they draw yourself working as a doctor. Some of the kids don't even put a person in the picture. It's all computers and medications and books. Yeah, and most of them are sitting behind a desk with a diploma on the wall. And again, no patient. It's a rare picture that shows a doctor, you know, handing a patient a tissue, if you know what I mean, not touching them with a stethoscope, you know, something mechanical. So it really will give them a totally different interpretation of how they see their role with patients.
Bernie, you're brilliant. Thank you. I will add that forthwith.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, we're working with...
Because it's a statement from them, if you know what I mean. It's not you criticizing them. It's their image. Yeah.
Of course it's their image. Yeah, and I think what we've loved so far about... We've done the first 5 days of the course, and now we meet twice a month by phone, and then we'll have a final 5-day at the end of this course in May. And what I have enjoyed so much is people just relaxing from their role and becoming human, and the way that we've touched each other, the way that we love each other. And I realize the structure of the course is important, you know, mostly because it gives a way for people to touch in a human way.
Yeah.
And that's what we're all here on Earth for, is to touch like that, to relax a little bit and let go. I love Parker Palmer, who says you got to make that shift from role to soul. And, boy, it's magic when that happens.
What I ask people as part of workshops and other things, I love saying, is life fair, and having an audience scream no. I say, it must be. You're all complaining. Then they laugh. To me, life is difficult. It's not unfair. We all have our problems. I also ask people how you'd introduce yourself to God, because it's about your self-worth, you know, when you're a child of God, or you can say to God, it's you, you know, versus your profession, or that you're a parent, or, you know, that we don't just live a role, but we accept our divine selves and, you know, can then look at ourselves differently. I always said, really, that I got into trouble because I am a minority group member. My parents loved me. I did well in school, and I got along with God. So I didn't realize what everybody else was going through. And, you know, and when you'd say to a patient, what's going on in your life, and have doctors yell at you, stop blaming your patient. But, you know, I'm not blaming them. I'm asking, why might you be vulnerable now? You know, if you've had a divorce, if you lost your job, if a loved one died, those are things that affect us. So, you know, and in our family, yes, we, you know, my mother would ask questions like that and also see difficulties as redirections, because that's why I say that I used to ask, again, at workshops, what mottos do you live by? Because I grew up with, do what will make you happy. Troubles are God's redirection. Something good will come of this. Material things are to make the world a better place for everyone. And so I would say, what mottos do you live by? And the guy would say, you didn't ask us what mottos we're dying by. You know, when you listen to what their parents said to them and how painful it is and how hard it is. The book Biology of Belief, you know, by Bruce Lipton. Because
Bruce.
You know, the epigenetics, I mean, that the genes don't make decisions. You know, identical twins don't get the same thing on the same day. And the twin who is missive and internalizes feelings is much more likely to come down with an illness than her, you know, raising hell of a sister kind of thing. But he said that up to the age of 6, the brainwave pattern in children is similar to that of somebody under hypnosis. So know, what you were saying about parenting, it's because we're hypnotized. And most of us are hypnotized in a negative way. So we grow up, and it's so hard to get come out of this spell and really create this new person that we need to be. And I always say to people,
absolutely,
don't wait for a disaster. I mean, Hemingway's line was, the world breaks everyone. Some of us become strong at the broken places. The tragedy is that if you wait for a disaster, you know, to then wake you up, and that's when everybody writes their book. My comment is, read the books that have been written already, so you don't have to, you know, write your own and go through all the suffering.
Well, you know, it is no end of amazement to me, and I think to most of us, if we stop to think about it, how much work we will put into protecting our pitiful place in hell and the belief systems that keep us stuck there. And it really does oftentimes take something big, a divorce or, you know, a financial loss or something, before we begin to reconsider, wait a minute, do I really have to live like this? And maybe instead of protecting my real estate in hell, I could find out how to live in a state of heaven on earth, which is definitely not a state where everything is perfect externally. It's that state. Elizabeth Edwards talked about this in her book Resilience, when she said resilience is about accepting, okay, my life has changed. This is how it is now. How can I make it the best life that can be? And that's what we need to be doing, because things are changing all the time. And I think right now,
and, Bernie, you know, you mentioned her. Let me bring this up, too, that if she came into my office with the breast cancer, I'd talk to her about her life and learned that she had a child who died, you know, or, and that her husband had an affair. Because I think those are things that also affect her health and her outcome and what happens within her body, you know, that these are issues that all need to be looked at. And I think she learned. You know, I'm always saying death isn't a failure. I mean, it's not about fighting a war against disease, but about helping to heal your life. And I think she worked at that.
She sure did, and she did a lot of good for a lot of people. I think she'll be remembered in a very beautiful way, not only by her children, but by so many people. And she kept going for a very long time with that breast cancer, too.
Yeah.
She definitely was a long survivor, which tells me that she found a sense of emotional nourishment somewhere, and that was really great role modeling.
And, you know, all the myths and religions and so forth tell us one simple thing. The only thing of permanence is love. Love is immortal. It makes all things immortal, while hate dies every minute. I mean, these are various quotes. But I think I always say to people, you want to live forever, love somebody. And love is a weapon. That's something else I tell people. You see, love thine enemies. When somebody's driving you nuts, I love saying to them, I love you. They don't know what the hell to do with me. I mean it. I've had people mad as hell at me walk away when I said, I love you. What do I do now? They leave. And people around who hear me say it, you know, say, wow, thank you. You taught me something. And let me say this. It could be as simple as you pulling into a parking space that somebody else wanted, and they start screaming at you. And you get out of your car and say, I love you. Then they drive away because they don't know what to do. You're not willing to fight and argue and... You know, so I always say to people, use love as a weapon. But I would add this, if your life is being threatened, yes, you can leave. I mean, if you're in a relationship that's affecting your health, then get out of there. But if not, say, if I brought love in, what would it accomplish? And you'll be amazed.
So true. It's absolutely so true. And the wisdom of the body, this is something I hope that when you are training medical students, Bernie, and doing the programs that you're doing, that really comes into things, because the body does speak. It speaks through dreams. And the body also speaks through illness. I was at one point in my life between marriages in a relationship like with the person my mother warned me about. And I should have been out of that relationship. And it was my body that told me. I developed this hideous rash all over my belly and my buttocks and my thighs. And, you know, one dermatologist said dry skin. I went to him again. I said, not gone, not dry skin. Finally, I went to a third dermatologist who said, it could be a lymphoma, you know, infiltrate in the skin. And it turned out to be, in fact, it was an activation of T cells that had come to live in my skin. But it wasn't lymphoma, thank God. It was, get this, an illness that afflicts largely adolescent males and goes away in 2 weeks. I had it for 2 years. And I finally said, while I'm not a person who always thinks that illness is a metaphor, this one sure was for me, because you've got two boundary systems, your immune system, which tells the difference between you and the outside world, and there it had gone right to my skin, right to my boundary. Killer cells saying, kill that, whatever's going on. And then, of course, your skin is the other boundary. And finally, you know, I looked at that, and it took the dermatologist who said, well, this could very well be a lymphoma, for me to say, is that what I really need to get away from this low-down, dirty dog? And it was because of that that I was actually able to take my power back and say, this is not a healthy relationship, and I don't have to be in it. And I think it's so very important. And again, it's not about blaming patients. Mm-hmm. It's about listening to patients. The body was my ally. Wasn't telling me, like, you're wrong and you're terrible. It was saying, come on, darling, you know, I'm pointing in another direction. There's another choice you can make, and together we can make that choice.
You know, Caroline Thomas, a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins years ago, had the medical students fill out a personality profile and draw a picture. And then she looked them all up 30 years or so later, and she was amazed. You know, I mean, she expected some personality to relate to what kind of disease you would have, you know, heart disease or emotional problems. But she was amazed that the drawings also predicted even which part of the body somebody would get cancer in. And, for instance, if somebody drew themselves without hands and arms, they were more likely to have emotional problems. And, you know, my interpretation would be you can't reach out, get a grip on things, you know, that type. So
yeah, you're helpless. Diagnostic.
Yeah, how you call yourself and your personality predicts what illnesses you can get. And I think when you're in, I see with anger, a lot of autoimmune diseases. You know, you keep it in and you end up attacking yourself and taking it out on yourself. So that's why it's important for people, as you say, not to blame. And it's another reason I started studying religion, because I have to give you a quote from 1826, Pope Leo XII. If you vaccinate yourself against smallpox, you are no longer a child of God, because God decides who gets smallpox. Imagine. And Billy Graham, credit to him. Does God want me to have cancer? His answer, not necessarily. I mean, I wrote him and he didn't answer me. I said, what do you mean not necessarily? Well, God could give you cancer so you become more spiritual and closer to God. So here's my test question, and this I often ask people when they're feeling guilt, you know, is God punishing me? I say, look, you go out to your car, and you can't find your car keys. God want you to walk home. Now, Billy Graham said to me, yeah, I'd walk home. I'd say, okay, you're living the sermon. But if he said, Siegel, don't be a nut, go back in the office and look for my keys, I'd say, then you're not living your message. See?
Right.
So what Maimonides said hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago was, if you lose your health, look for it. You've lost something. And the Bible tells us, if you find what your neighbor lost, return it to him. And I may add one more quote from Maimonides that blew my mind when you talked about parenting. 900 years ago, he wrote, if people took as good care of themselves as they do their animals, they would suffer fewer illnesses. And that's what blows my mind, too. When people have a cat die of lung cancer and their other cats are developing breathing problems, their letter to Cat Fancy magazine states, Doug and I now smoke in the yard. We're not killing our cats anymore. We hope you're not killing yours.
You guys are fantastic. Let me jump in here.
Yes, but
saying
it's okay to kill yourself.
Stephen, you can't get a word in edgewise.
Go ahead. I'll be
you guys are so fantastic to listen to. I mean, we could do it all day. And I also want to make sure we get a few questions from our audience in as well. So you guys open for a few questions?
Absolutely.
If I can pick that up.
Great. So if people could touch two if, on the live line if you have a question, or you can also type it into the side field there for the webcast. So again, touch two, and it looks like we have some hands up, and I will get to Jerry. You're live.
Hi, this is Jerry Dow, Forsyth Joan.
Hey, Jerry. How you doing?
Good. The question I have comes from, for the two of you, and basically it comes from Jerry and Esther Hicks. When we have these reoccurring situations like depression and so on, of course they say, well, that's because you're attracting it. But if I myself am a giver and a helper and compassionate, of course those are the people I'm trying to help, and those are the people that keep coming into my life. How do you find the ones that you want to spend the rest of your life with?
Okay, Bernie.
I mean, my comment would be you say no to things you don't want to do and people you don't want to be with. As a gentleman with cancer said, when he was told he had about 6 months to live, I spend more time with the things and people I love and less time with the things and people I don't love or who don't love me. So you just make a decision. Is this good for me or not? And if it isn't, then the answer is no. Otherwise, you're denying yourself. You're saying no to yourself.
Well, you're right.
I may add, nurses have a lot of trouble saying no. You know, it's that part of their personality. But they're saying no to themselves when they're out there helping everyone with no limitations. So set limits.
Yeah, well, that's big. That's how we burn. That's exactly how you burn out. That was one of the big parts of writing Fried, was really looking, helping people look. What are my boundaries? And if you eliminate that which you really do not want to do, the amazing thing is that the part of you that enjoys life, the part of you that's attracted to healthy things, the part of you that loves simply comes forward, that you don't have to search for that part because it's your deepest identity. You just have to, like, peel away the layers of stuff that you don't want to do that covers all that up.
And two quotes, one from someone who thought she was going to die of AIDS and became HIV negative. When you live in your heart, magic happens. And from Carl Jung, the future is unconsciously prepared long in advance and therefore can be guessed by clairvoyance. So the decisions you're making every day relate to your future. Do create it.
I think so. And just getting back to the law of attraction, I think generally speaking, first of all, bad things happen to people no matter what your belief system is. We all attract life, which has its pluses and minuses. There's that. But secondly, if you really begin to live more in your heart, and that is you forgive, you do things that give you joy, you do things that help other people, and you begin to say no more to those things that drain you, then your heart does attract more love into your life. And I think even though grace is supposed to be an unearned gift, I'm more of the Sufi frame of mind that when you take one step toward the divine, it takes 100 steps back toward you. So you take a step to free yourself or to be more loving, boy, it does come flooding back. That's certainly been my experience.
I've been refocusing on what is called the Sabbath time, which doesn't have to be, you know, a religious day, but that you take a day for yourself or 2 hours of Sabbath time, that you quiet yourself and have that time to just take it easy and you don't have to do something.
It's so important. It's so important. You know, the ancient derivation of the word Sabbath comes from the old Babylonian goddess Ishtar. And once a month on the full moon, there was Sabbath, Sabbaton. And what it really meant was heart rest, because the moon was neither waxing nor waning. And then finally it got to like be this once a week thing. And we really need that, because if we're doing and doing and doing all the time, the joy can really go out of life, because there's not time to be a child. There's not time to play. And time to play is what we all really need, which is why it's so much fun to be here with you, Bernie. This doesn't feel like work. It's play.
Right.
Anyhow, Jerry Dalforth, did we even touch on an answer to your question?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Thank you. Now we'd
Thanks,
like to
Jerry, for your question.
Thanks, Jerry. Brenda from the webcast asks, any comments from the two of you on dealing with chronic pain?
Well, right off the bat is to say, what does the pain feel like? To describe it. And then take everything else in your life that fits that description and eliminate it. So if you said, again, pressure, sticking a knife in my back, burning, okay, what's burning you up? What's causing you pressure? Who's sticking a knife in your back? And when you eliminate those things, yes, the pain does get better. Believe me.
What an absolutely luminous answer. That's really great, Bernie. To use the pain or any other symptom as a way to really reflect on what's going on in your life, and not only reflect on it, but take action on it. I think that's absolutely terrific. And I think what's very important about that approach is that paying attention to your pain is scary, because when you do that, it actually feels worse, because a lot of what we do to help ourselves with pain is to try to distract ourselves. Mm-hmm. But if you can just kind of sit with it, be mindful of it, and really look at it. You start by focusing on your breathing. This is something that Jon Kabat-Zinn might tell you,
yep,
in terms of mindfulness and pain. Focus on your breathing, and then you can really do that exercise, Bernie, and focus in just witnessing and observing what is the pain. And sometimes just by focusing on it, it gets a lot less, because you're not adding a layer of suffering to the pain. Because I know, because I used to have a lot of very serious migraines when I was younger, that as soon as a migraine would hit, a whole inner dialogue about the pain would start up, which was, you know, oh me, poor, poor, pitiful me, everybody else can go out in college, it's Saturday night, and instead I'm barfing into a bowl, and I have this hideous pain. And I had a whole helplessness thing that started up about the pain. And as I got older and learned how to meditate and realized, okay, I can just be with that pain, I found that just the act of being with it created a lot of space around it. And, of course, I'm lucky, because my kind of pain, this is where I love pharmaceuticals when used rightly. And so I know being tired gives me migraines. Feeling overworked and overwhelmed gives me migraines. But sometimes, you know, just traveling gives me migraines. And I love to have pills that will help me with that. But it's also been really, really useful to see why they do or when they come up in my life. And very useful to say, I can be with my pain even if it's there. I can breathe. I can watch it. I can listen to it.
The meditation, hypnosis. Also, as I said, losing track of time. I know when I've had an injury that I could barely stand up. I had injured my back. I could paint a portrait standing for hours, and I could stand in the operating room for 6 hours and not be aware of my pain. So when you say to people, draw a picture of yourself, some of them draw their backache. They are their pain. So you also have to ask yourself, do I need the pain to get attention, to get people to do things for me, to care for me? And my hope would be that you will evolve into the person who doesn't need an illness to feel of value and to get attention from the rest of the world.
Hmm. Well, the two of you, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I think it's completely healing and opening and restoring just listening to the two of you. You're clearly just fountains of wisdom and love, and I'm sure that a lot of folks would love to stay in contact with both of you. So perhaps we could... if you would like us to share your email with Bernie and his, I think you have an assistant who can keep you up to date on latest book releases and other stuff, you can touch one right now. And Bernie, maybe any other things you especially want to share about upcoming events or activities?
So
people are opting in one.
For people, Bernie Siegel, SIEGELMD.com is my website. And I don't have people between me and the people who contact me. So if you have contact, it comes to my private email. It's me. I don't have a staff.
Yeah, we would just send you a list so that you can add them to your newsletter list.
Yes, yeah, and through the website, they can get onto the newsletter list, see where I'm speaking, what I've done, articles by me, all kinds of things. You know, so it's like listening to me, but reading what I have to say.
Great, great. Well, thank you. And Joan, do you, if people would like to stay connected with you or be on your email list, we can have them press 2, and maybe anything about upcoming events, or maybe even mention about the Soul Care course that is on the horizon that we'll let people know about when we're ready to hatch
that. That's right. If people go to my website, which is just my name, joanborisenko.com, you can, just like Bernie's website, see where I'm going to go. There's a button on the front page to learn more about the Soul Care course. And then one of the things I love to do is various trips. I'm going to Teotihuacan, to the Great Pyramids of Teotihuacan, with a friend of mine, Lee McCormick, who is a shaman. And periodically we do journeys there. That's where Don Miguel Ruiz takes people. It was an old Toltec mystery school, these great pyramidal ruins. And we go through some pretty amazing rituals getting down there to rid oneself of the false self and get more in touch with who you authentically are. And the other thing is I love to be on Facebook. If people go to my fan page, I did a lot of research for my book Fried, which is about to come out, on Facebook by asking questions and getting stories, and we have an amazing community there. So please do join me, and once again, like Bernie, it's not somebody else you're interacting with, it's me. Fun.
Great. Well, you guys are just, I wish we could have you all the time. You're just so warm and just insightful, and the stories are wonderful as well. So thank you so much for just being who you are, for integrating all of the best of Western medicine and having so much heart and soul and really offering a path forward for all of us. So thank you both for sharing that with us today.
Thank you.
Welcome, Stephen. Bernie, how sweet to connect with you again.
Yes.
Beautiful. Great. Well, thank you again. And so as Bernie and Joan leave the line now, they're on to their other things for the day. We have the opportunity for people to stay and connect with each other some. So we have 8,000 people from all over the world who have signed up for this summit. So there's a lot of great folks here that you can connect with. So what we'll do is put you in groups of 4 so you can just discuss anything that you want to share, perhaps about your own practice or your own life, and how you can apply these ideas. So we'll assume if you're sticking around that you would like to be put into groups of 4. And then we'll have our next panel on the neuroscience of well-being, which is going to be really interesting, bridging science, some of the latest studies out, and how that affects our understanding of how to create real well-being. So that's at 3 o'clock, and then we'll have Norm Shealy and Chris Hibbard at 4:30, and so that'll wrap up our summit for the weekend. It's really been a great journey already, so thank you for joining us, and now we'll put you into groups of 4 to connect and meet some other folks and discuss what you've been learning. So you're now in groups of 4, and I'll see you again at 3 o'clock.